Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Go to www.audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin for your free audiobook download.
Macro Freedom, The Fat Police, The Chicken Little Gene, The Presidential Debate at Large Berth, Slacktivism, and of course, Neo-Prudentism. Just a few of the many concepts brought to you by Common Sense with Dan Carlin.
What's the most powerful entity on the planet? Let me broaden that out a little bit more. What are the most powerful entities on the planet? I bet we could have a great, long-term, wonderful debate if a bunch of us got together in a room and started putting forward our nominee for the most powerful entity or the most powerful entities on the planet. And I bring that up because, you know, in a very broad sense, and I've said this many times on this program, you know, I think the planet is evolving towards a new reality. And I don't think any of us know what that is. I mean, I love the lyrics from that Buffalo Springfield song in the 1960s. We've quoted it before, where they said, "There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear." Because that really describes so often the future, you know, that mankind's heading for at any given time. It's part of the reason why historians always want to get several decades away from events so that they can get a better idea of the big picture, because trying to figure out what's going on in your own time period is a little like trying to decide what the picture on that billboard is if you're standing 5 inches away from it. Sometimes you got to back up a little bit and get some distance before the picture becomes clear. And we're living in the middle of the picture now, and we're talking about, you know, what the picture is. We're a long way from a destination that we're heading closer towards all the time, but none of us is quite sure what that destination is. But you can look and see, you know, what sort of entities are deciding on the course changes. And this gets us back to this initial question. Who's in charge? Who are the big power brokers? And who are the ones deciding, you know, where we're going? Now, there's an interesting dichotomy in the modern world. The interesting dichotomy is we live in a period now, which is really unheralded in human history, where the vast majority of people on the planet believe that the only form of government that has any sort of legitimacy at all is some sort of democratic government, some sort of representative government, a government that governs by the will and consent of the governed. The fall of the Soviet Union kind of solidified that. There are obviously very big countries that don't pay anything more than lip service to that idea. But this is really the triumph of representative government in world history. And yet, in a funny way, you could make a pretty darn good argument that in none of those representative countries do the govern really govern. I have a almanac, the famous People's Almanac that came out in 1975, and they have a wonderful section on world nations. And the way it's organized is, you know, they'll tell you the square footage or the square miles of it and where it's located and all these. And then they have a section that says who rules for each of the countries, and who rules is the section where they say, well, this is a representative system with two houses of parliament, blah, 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 blah. And they go through the official rundown of the country's governmental type. And then they have a category right after the who rules section entitled who really rules. And it's a fun little piece that basically, you know, points out what we kind of all know, that just because you're supposed to be country type A doesn't mean that you actually are. And under the section for the United States, written in 1975, 40 years ago, when it says who really rules, here's what it says, quote, "There are many forces at work in U.S. society, but the most powerful by far are the interlocking directorates of the major banks, corporations, and insurance companies with the backing of the leaders of the military." End quote. Now, let's recall that we are a country that is supposed to be run by the will of the people, and as Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig points out, by the people alone. If I put you in a think tank somewhere, a little mental experiment, and you got hired at this think tank because you are an outside-the-box thinker who can find solutions, and you get hired and you get put in a room with a bunch of other people like you who can find solutions and are outside-the-box thinkers, and the think tank or the company gets a client who shows up at your door offering, you know, lots of money, as clients tend to do to these kind of firms. If you can solve a problem they have, and it's a corporate client, and the problem that they have is they want some change, a law changed or a regulatory alteration or something that involves the government, let's just say here in the United States, but this applies to a lot of other countries too, they want this change, and the problem that they have that you need to help them with is that the voters of the country don't want the change. There's not a lot of popular support for what this company needs. And your job as the facilitator organization is to help get this company to their goal. So as the outside-the-box thinker that you are, if this company can't get something easily passed because the voters of the country don't agree with what they want, what would you tell them to do? What's your advice? I can think of a couple of things you might throw out there. One would be maybe start some sort of a campaign to influence public opinion. But if you just judge this situation on, you know, what historically has worked the best advice you could give that corporate client were you to try to help them facilitate their goals over the wishes of the Democratic electorate, you would tell them to try to see to it that the electorate did not know about what you wanted and did not hear that you were trying to get the change you wanted and never found out that the change happened. In other words, the best advice you could give this corporation would be to keep it secret. Now, we've talked a lot about secrecy on this program, and many times the sorts of secrecy we bring up involve national security questions. And many of you, and a ton of the electorate in a ton of countries around the world, are willing to give up all sorts of freedoms and protections in order to, you know, safeguard your life or your children's life, and to prevent things like terror attacks and all this, right? To keep military secrets. There's a whole bunch of things in the national security realm where secrets seem apropos. Now, I've told you many times, folks, that when you actually see what the secrets are that the government is keeping from you on the grounds of national security and all that, it's often stuff that is just kept from you because if you knew about it, you'd be pissed. But nonetheless, it's a difficult thing to argue against because, you know, people don't want to lose their children in a terrorist attack, right? Fear is a major, you know, argument all by itself. But a perfect example of how this same dynamic, the same thing you would tell someone if they showed up to your company and said, we need this regulatory change, but the voters aren't for it, and you would say, well, don't tell the voters. A perfect example of this is playing out right now with a couple of major trade agreements that are almost ready for countries to start, you know, deciding whether or not to sign on board with them. One is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Many of you have heard about this, also known as the TPP. Another one is sort of the European or Atlantic version of the TTP. It's called the TTIP, and that stands for the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And both of these involve dozens of countries, and at least in the Trans-Pacific Partnership version, more than 30,000 pages of new changes, I guess you could say. The agreement is at least 30,000 pages long, and it impacts the sovereign rights of every nation that's likely to sign on board with this. And again, like so many of these trade deals, it's the kind of thing where if voters in these nations who are about to sign on board to these things had the right to vote themselves up or down on these treaties, they would have a very hard time getting passed. So what the governments involved do is they don't give them that right. And in fact, they don't tell them what's in it. Now, if you're one of those people that feels like secrecy can be justified on national security questions because life, you know, and property and all these things are defended from terrorists and we need to have secrets in the national security realm, how do you feel about similar secrets when it comes to things like trade deals? When in fact, it's so much more obviously designed to cut the voters in democracies out of the debate. Let me read a little bit of this to you, but I want to broaden it out because it's a much more interesting question than just these trade deals. And after all, we've talked about these trade deals many times already for many years. I mean, obviously, you're talking to someone when you talk to me who's an opponent of all of these things. So I'm not to be trusted when it comes to, being very fair-minded about it. I oppose NAFTA. I oppose GATT. I oppose the WTO. I mean, to me, all these things are done wrong and done by people who don't care about the working situation in any of these countries. They have their own cares and concerns. And, again, that I don't begrudge them at all, but I don't think should come at the expense of the democratic voters in all these other countries. And to me, if these policies would be opposed by the voters in Australia or Canada or the United States or Europe or anywhere else, when made public, well, then they shouldn't be agreed to. More on that in a minute. First, let's talk about some of the specifics a little bit. First, let me point out how we know about this stuff. If it's also secret, how do we have any information? Well, WikiLeaks actually divulged a bunch of this stuff. And if you've listened to this program before, you know that I think entities like WikiLeaks are important. And I think they're important because exactly this kind of situation seems to merit somebody telling us what's going on. I would prefer it was our governments. In a perfect world, I would prefer that we had people we trusted who could really, you know, make the logical distinction between what should and should not be secret, but we don't. We have corrupted individuals who are working in systems that have been co-opted and who keep things secret for their own purposes. Secrecy is one of the great powers that government officials have. And again, if you look at what gets kept secret, folks, it is almost never the sorts of things that we would all agree that's a good reason to keep something secret. They are to hide mistakes or to hide policies that we wouldn't agree with. Again, more on this in a second. But here's a story that appeared on my birthday, 11/14/2013, after the people at WikiLeaks again released some of the secret information about these treaties, which will change life in all these countries that are agreeing to these things, with the voters of those countries never being allowed to know what's being argued about. This is, as I said, from a Forbes article. And of course, Forbes is a very pro-business magazine, from 11/14/2013, entitled "Outcry Follows Leak of Secret Trade Negotiations." From the beginning of the piece, quote, "With two previous versions leaked, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement was already causing rumblings of concern. But WikiLeaks' release this week of the latest draft has brought controversy to a peak. The deal, the story says, is currently being negotiated in secret between the U.S., Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam, and there are proposals to extend it further. However, the story says, the 30,000-page draft agreement published by WikiLeaks reveals intellectual property protection being broadened in an astonishing number of areas, from strengthening the rights of pharmaceutical companies to allowing the patenting of plants and animals. It is unsurprisingly supported by more than 600 large corporations, from Nike and Walmart to General Electric and Pfizer," end quote. The story points out that while the governments of all these countries say this will be great for trade and make everyone's lives better, which is what they've said about every other trade agreement that's been passed, and we all know how those have turned out, the story says, quote, "Meanwhile, over 80 law professors have written to President Obama, members of Congress, and the U.S. Trade Representative calling for public oversight of the intellectual property proposals. They, too, are concerned about the way the process is being conducted," quote, and this is from the piece written by the law professors to the president, quote, "Unfortunately, TPP is not being negotiated through an inclusive process. On the contrary, the administration has taken extraordinary efforts to keep these deliberations secret from the general public. The United States," they write, "reportedly promoted and signed an agreement with other TPP member countries that precludes official release of any proposals for the text of the agreement until 4 years after it's concluded," end quote. The Electronic Frontier Foundation described many of the TPP proposals as, quote, "an anti-user wish list of industry-friendly policies," end quote. The TPP allows something called an investor-state dispute settlement, which was part of other trade agreements that I've been against in the past, which essentially allows companies to sue governments if they don't like policies, regulations, and whatnot in those countries, and they believe that those policies or regulations impact their ability to do business, and then the dispute is taken to like a group of lawyers who litigate on these things on an international level, right? So if one company in the Netherlands, for example, tells Canada that not allowing a certain additive into gasoline produced by the Dutch company impacts their business, they can take it to a sort of an arbitration court, and if Canada loses, they either might have to allow it or they might have to compensate that company. This is becoming pretty commonplace, giving corporations the right to essentially sue for damages if countries and voters in those countries, you know, create laws or restrictions that impact anyone's ability to do business that's a part of this agreement. It's one of the things that unites some liberals with conservatives on this. You know, there's sort of a pro-Wall Street group in both the Democratic and Republican parties in the U.S. that are for these kinds of things. But then there are people on the farther left and the farther right that scream bloody murder over sovereignty questions. The idea is that these supersede the rights of Americans, well, or Canadians or Australians or Europeans to change these things. And that there should be no rules that supersede in a democracy the rights of the voters in that country. There was a story that appeared in the New York Times just a couple of days ago, March 25th, 2015, about these lawsuits that could be, you know, filed as a part of these trade deals. This one's entitled Trans-Pacific Partnership Seen as Door for Foreign Suits Against U.S. by Jonathan Wiseman March, Dateline Washington, from the beginning of the piece, quote, "An ambitious 12-nation trade accord pushed by President Obama would allow foreign corporations to sue the United States government for actions that undermine their investment, quote-unquote, expectations and hurt their business, according to a classified document. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, a cornerstone of Mr. Obama's remaining economic agenda, would grant broad powers to multinational companies operating in North America, South America, and Asia. Under the accord, still under negotiation but nearing completion, companies and investors would be empowered to challenge regulations, rules, government actions, and court rulings, federal, state, or local, before tribunals organized under the World Bank or the United Nations. Backers of the emerging trade accord, the story says, which is supported by a wide variety of business groups and favored by most Republicans, say that it is in line with previous agreements that contain similar provisions." End quote. In other words, it's no different than the North American Free Trade Agreement, no different than CAFTA, no different than the GATT stuff. In other words, the trade agreements that many of us have pointed out have done no good. I mean, bad things. And they're basically saying, oh, no worse than those. From later in this piece, the New York Times, by the way, was working with WikiLeaks on some of these releases. And so from the middle of the piece, it talks about one of the controversial parts of the trade agreement that was found out once WikiLeaks released it to the public, and says, quote, "The chapter in the draft of the trade deal, dated January 20th, 2015, and obtained by the New York Times in collaboration with the group WikiLeaks, is certain to kindle opposition from both the political left and the political right. The sensitivity of the issue is reflected in the fact that the cover mandates that the chapter not be declassified until 4 years after the Trans-Pacific Partnership comes into force or trade negotiations end." End quote. In other words, you don't get to know about this before it's voted on. You don't get to know about this until it's been in force so long, it would be tough to undo it. Now, here's the part that should upset everyone. Not only is this a secret from the general public, but even the representatives in the House of Representatives, for example, have not been able to see the actual wording of the agreement. And they're screaming about it, too. It kind of shows how, once again, we're in the midst of changes going on in the governmental system, where more and more it's the executive branch of government that matters in the United States. And the Senate and the House of Representatives, in part due to their own lack of wanting to take responsibility, have less and less responsibility. It's the difference between what the Constitution gives them in terms of responsibility and what 200 and some years of actual practice has decided that they have. One of the stories I have has a quote from Representative Alan Grayson, the Florida Democrat, talking about this exact problem with secrecy and these trade agreements, and he says, quote, "I'm not happy about it. It's part of a multi-year campaign of deception and destruction. Why do we classify information?" he asks. "It's to keep sensitive information out of the hands of foreign governments. In this case, foreign governments already have this information. They're the people the administration is negotiating with. The only purpose of classifying this information is to keep it from the American people." End quote. And this brings back an interesting piece from a couple of years ago from Elizabeth Warren. Does that name ring a bell? It's funny because people who listen to this program always know who this person is. I'll bring it up in the general public, and it's amazing how many people don't know. Elizabeth Warren is one of these politicians that if I could stand politicians, I would be tempted to be friendly towards. I like non-establishment people, but I don't trust these politicians because I've been burned many times like many of you have. It's one thing to say all the right things. It's another thing to vote for these people and then watch when they get into office how they just ignore, you know, their policy positions. But at least based on what she says, Elizabeth Warren is one of these people that's opposing these kind of things, opposing the secrecy, opposing the fact that the average Democratic voter in a Democratic country seems to be emasculated in terms of having any real say in the direction that things are evolving towards. She wrote a letter to the guy who's the lead dog on some of these trade negotiations for the White House, a guy named Michael Froman, a guy who used to work for Citigroup, by the way. So this shows you who the people are involved in some of these negotiations. Now, Elizabeth Warren is one of these people, by the way, that thinks Citigroup is so potentially dangerous in terms of the amount of power it has that she's publicly suggested that maybe it should be broken up. So that shows you that she's doing some tilting at windmills herself right now and saying some interesting things. So she writes this letter to Froman way back on June 13th, 2013, and essentially in the middle of the letter points out what we kind of all are understanding the more you read about this, that the big argument for secrecy on the part of the administration and the other governments around the world negotiating this is that if the stipulations were made public, the people in the countries that are democracies would oppose these things. So putting you back in your role as the think tank consultant helping these companies facilitate getting from point A to point B, you tell them, don't tell the public what's going on, right? So in the middle of Elizabeth Warren's note to Michael Froman, the assistant to the president, on June 13, 2013, she says, quote, "I have heard the argument that transparency would undermine the administration's policy to complete the trade agreement because public opposition would be significant. This argument is exactly backwards," she writes. "If transparency would lead to widespread public opposition to a trade agreement, then that trade agreement should not be the policy of the United States. I believe in transparency and democracy, and I think the U.S. trade representative should too," end quote. In a piece written on January 6, 2015 for Global Research, independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who is a socialist, by the way, wrote about how upset he is that not only are the people of the country cut out of knowing about the deal, but as the Florida House of Representatives member we mentioned earlier was saying, that the government officials are cut out of the deal. Once again, we're seeing the stakes raised. For some time now, we've seen the electorate cut out of, you know, some of these deals. Now we're watching more and more of the actual government officials that are voted into power by the electorate cut out of the deal. Sanders writes, quote, "It is incomprehensible to me that the leaders of major corporate interests are actively involved in the writing of the TPP, while the elected officials of this country have little or no knowledge as to what is in it." He continues, quote, "It is incomprehensible to me that the leaders of major corporate interest who stand to gain enormous financial benefits from this agreement are actively involved in the writing of the TPP, while at the same time the elected officials of this country representing the American people have little or no knowledge as to what's in it." He continues, quote, "Members of Congress must have the opportunity to read what is in the TPP and closely analyze the potential impact this free trade agreement would have on the American people long before the Senate votes to give the president fast-track trade promotion authority," end quote. Now, that's another question. For those who don't know, fast-track trade authority is something that's been used in all these trade agreements. What it essentially does is take the ability of the legislative branch of this country to change any of the agreements out of their hands. and forces them to either vote up or down on the whole thing. Now, this does two things. One, it simply cuts them out of the debate. If they want a free trade agreement, they have to vote for the things they don't like with the things that they do. But the other thing that it does is it eliminates that whole period where the Congress actually discusses the provisions in the agreement. With fast-track authority, there isn't a debate. So nobody ever gets up there and once again says on C-SPAN, what's in it? If you don't have fast-track authority, then you can never comply with that rule that says this has to be kept secret for 4 years after it's passed, right? Because those secrets would come out during the debate. With fast-track authority, there is no debate. Now, once again, we get back to the question of secrecy, folks, and I know many of you are willing to concede the government needs to keep secrets to keep us safe, and many of you are willing to put up with the secrets that aren't very important in that realm in order to keep secret the things that are, right? So how do you feel about it when it involves things that are not national security related and that do not involve lives? The government says that we can't have these agreements if it's open to the public and the public gets to read them. But then how can the people in these democratic countries have any say at all in whether or not they agree with what these trade deals mandate? And they mandate huge changes. One of the best summations I saw about why people should be concerned about these things and what's going on involves the TTIP negotiations by a guy named John Hillary, who's one of the directors of a group called War on Want. It's a workers' rights organization. But he labels pretty concisely the situation when he writes, quote, "The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership is a comprehensive free trade and investment treaty currently being negotiated in secret between the European Union and the USA. The intention to launch TTIP negotiations was first announced by President Barack Obama in his State of the Union address in February 2013, and the first round of negotiations took place between the European Commission and U.S. officials in July of the same year. The aim is to rush through the talks as swiftly as possible, with no details entering the public domain, in the hopes that they can be concluded before the peoples of Europe and the USA find out the true scale of the TTIP threat." He writes, quote, "As officials from both sides acknowledge, the primary aim of TTIP is not to stimulate trade through removing tariffs between the EU and USA, as these are already at minimal levels. The main goal of TTIP is, by their own admission, to remove regulatory barriers," barriers is in quotes, "which restrict the potential profits to be made by transnational corporations on both sides of the Atlantic." He says, "Yet these barriers are in reality some of our most prized social standards and environmental regulations, such as labor rights, food safety rules, regulations on the use of toxic chemicals, digital privacy laws, and even new banking safeguards introduced to prevent a repeat of the 2008 financial crisis. The stakes," he writes, "in other words, could not be higher." End quote. I read an interview by Hillary in an article on the left-leaning website Truthout, where he describes the level of secrecy in the TTIP, and he says, quote, "The level of secrecy surrounding these negotiations means that ordinary people across Europe and most of the national members of parliament have no idea what's going on. The European Commission placed a 30-year ban," he says, "on all public access to the key documents behind TTIP right at the beginning of the negotiations. Any members of the European Parliament who are given access to the special reading rooms where they can see some of these documents, they have to sign the documents," he says, "promising that they will not share any of what they've seen outside that room." He says, "Really, it's like a scene from the Stalinist Soviet past, where you have individual documents marked with secret markings so that they can trace the source of any leaks when the documents do go out in the public domain." He says, "It's profoundly untransparent and anti-democratic, and it's destroying any credibility within the European Commission itself." End quote. He says that this is elevating corporations to the status of nation states. Which brings me to something I wanted to get into in this piece. Part of what maybe you could argue we are evolving towards. If I asked you who was more powerful, a consortium of 600 of the world's top corporations, which are some of the people supporting these trade deals, for example, or Ecuador, what would you say? Well, I think it'd be pretty obvious that it would probably only take one or two or three of the largest corporations to have more real power than a country the size of Ecuador. I don't even think that's debatable, is it? Becomes a much more interesting question, though, when you say, how many major global corporations would it take to have more power than, say, the United States government? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if you could say we're far past that point and they have much more power, or they're nowhere near that point. I don't know, but I just know that at some point, the way things are going, you could make a case that we're evolving towards a time where the nation state becomes something that is less powerful than these transnational business entities. Now, a little review of the history, right? International Relations 101 is going to teach you, rightly or wrongly, by the way, that something called the Peace of Westphalia in 1648 is the determining moment. It ended the 30 Years' War, where the sovereign entity of the nation state was proclaimed to be the highest, you know, element of political power on the planet. That's the moment when, you know, nation states become the big dog on the scene, as internationally agreed, right, by the great powers. Now, the 1648 treaty suffered a combination of blows during the 20th century, a couple of world wars, for example, that helped put the nail in the coffin of the idea that balance of power, you know, principles and nation states could necessarily be trusted to not destroy each other. And that's when you start to see these supranational entities being suggested as an improvement over the Peace of Westphalia circumstances. For example, the League of Nations from 1919 at the end of the First World War, an idea that, you know, instead of having a nation be equal to every other nation in terms of sovereign power, that the peace of the world sometimes required that consortiums of nations, you know, keep rogue elements in line. It's the beginning of what's called collective security. This idea that, you know, if some rogue nation arrives on the scene, the other nations combine against it and sort of act as like a global traffic cop and keep it in line. And what the League of Nations proved in the 20s and 30s was that, well, as designed, it couldn't do the job. So we have another world war, and the new and updated version of the League of Nations arrives on the scene called the United Nations. Same sort of deal. Obviously, you know, after the Second World War, some of the holes in the United Nations organization appear as well. But the concept, you know, this element that the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia has its limitations comes into play even more clearly, and that consortiums of nations are perhaps, or even some sort of, you know, what maybe some conspiracy theorists would call a world government becomes, you know, considered to be somehow preferable in terms of keeping the peace and whatnot. But what happens if governments themselves become bit players compared to the power of global transatlantic corporations? You know, we talk a lot on this program about the problems with corruption in the U.S. system. But in a funny way, if you look across the democracies on this planet, you see similar situations impacting those countries too. And these trade deals help create the situations where, in some of these countries where the corruption levels are not anywhere near as bad as in the United States, if these trade deals get passed, it will create chinks in the armor of these countries, opening the door to the same sort of corporate influence that has helped corrupt our government. And I should point out, just to be fair, it's not just corporate influence that corrupts our government. I mean, you know, because that makes it sound like a sort of a business-oriented corruption, whereas we all know that the corruption crosses the spectrum from left-wing, you know, sorts of interest groups to right-wing sorts of interest groups. Once you open up the door and say that this is a pay-for-play government, anyone that wants to play is going to pay, and it's not going to be confined to right-wing groups. But it's these businesses that work so well together that they can form these consortiums and they can essentially negotiate in secret with governments to do these kind of things. Now, if that's true and transnational corporations begin to become more powerful than governments, what are the implications for democracy? Because I've been in a lot of conversations theoretical ones where discussions will center around the question of how large an entity can get and still remain democratic. And I remember one in particular where we were discussing ancient Athens, which, of course, is the historic birthplace of democracy as it stood in ancient Athens anyway. And people will talk about how that only really worked because of the size and scope of the situation, and that once things become too large, the whole democratic element begins to be watered down. Americans will make a similar case sometimes when they talk about federalism and the idea of local control. And it goes something like this. They'll say something like, okay, if you're in a city of 15,000 people and you're voting for your city councilor, well, you're one of, assuming everybody in the town was an adult, 15,000 votes, right? But now if we're talking about your state legislator, you may be one of 10 million votes. Now, you've just lost a certain amount of power, haven't you? From 1 in 15,000ths to 1 in 12 million or whatever it is, right? So it's less democratic once you move from the local to the state level. Well, then it's correspondingly less democratic when you move from the state to the federal level, right? Now you're one of 300 million Americans, and however many vote, that's the percentage of democratic power that you wield. So what happens if we extend this to a world system? Imagine there really was just one world democratic government, and now you are one vote out of 5 billion or 6 billion votes, right? And of course, that assumes that democracy plays any role in this at all. Once again, can you really say you have any control over where things are going if you're not allowed to know what's being done? Is there anyone out there who thinks that WikiLeaks was wrong for leaking the information about these trade agreements? I mean, I can't imagine someone who thinks, absolutely, Dan, these trade agreements have to be kept secret, and they have to be kept secret years after they're passed. Why? For what reason other than the fact that the voters in this country or Australia or Canada or the European Union aren't going to be for these things if they see them, and they're going to be mad at the legislators who voted for these things in their name without telling them what's in it, or who voted for this stuff without knowing even themselves what's in it? In other words, once again, we see secrecy used as a way to both cover people's rear ends and to do things that if the public knew about them, the public would be pissed. As Elizabeth Warren had said in that note, if there's going to be significant public pushback to this stuff, if the public knows about it, and that's the reason you keep it secret, it's all backwards. You shouldn't be doing it if a large segment of an electorate in a democratic state doesn't want it, right? That's the whole idea behind a democracy, isn't it? So a couple of interesting developments, though, that we might be able to point to as potentially, well, I don't even know if it's hopeful as much as it is interesting. The first one has to do with something that was posted on Reuters' website yesterday, March 27, 2015, concerning, once again, Elizabeth Warren. I don't know if I believe Elizabeth Warren. I don't know if I believe any politicians anymore in what they say. I can only go on what they say and say, I'm glad she's saying it. I think there's a value in making these public pronouncements, even if the politician doesn't mean it, because it stokes, a public acknowledgement of the problem. In this case, apparently, Elizabeth Warren is considered to be so anti-bank that the banks are telling the Democratic Party that if they can't tone down this anti-bank message, they're not going to get any more money from banks. This is from Emily Flitter on Reuters, from 3/27/2015, from the beginning of the piece, Dateline, New York. Quote, big Wall Street banks are so upset with U.S. Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren's call for them to be broken up that some have discussed withholding campaign donations to Senate Democrats in symbolic protests, sources familiar with the discussion said. Representatives from Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, and Bank of America have met to discuss ways to urge Democrats, including Warren and Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, to soften their party's tone toward Wall Street, sources familiar with the discussion said this week. End quote. The story goes on to point out that some of the entities haven't decided what to do yet. Citigroup has decided to withhold donations at this point from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee over concerns, the story says, that Senate Democrats could give Warren and lawmakers who share her views more power. In other words, we're not going to give you money if you put Elizabeth Warren on any sorts of commissions or boards that would control anything we do. So they're flexing their muscle. the anger stems mostly, it says in this article, over comments she made in a December 12 speech where she mentioned Citigroup several times as an example of a bank that had grown too large, saying that it should have been broken apart as part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law. So, folks, what you have here is an example of maybe how the corruption in our system prevents what we would call populists. And you could have populism on the left and populism on the right. And in funny ways, populism on the left and the right agree on certain things, one of which is often sovereignty and the idea that banks, as just one group, should not be controlling major aspects of the country's, you know, evolution and direction. And so here you see how this corruption actually works in practice, right? The strong-arming of an opinion, the decisions by these banks who give to both major parties to say, if you give more power to your populist wing, you can count, you know, us out in terms of our donations. Now, remember, part of the problem with reform is that the Supreme Court has ruled that these banks, just as one example, are people, right? These corporations are the equivalent of people, which makes no sense at all for a couple of reasons. One, people die. Okay, so at some point you become a non-factor. These corporations are like vampires. They can exist for centuries. The other reason is that, you know, you as an American citizen with a right to participate in your governmental system, do that as an American. These companies are transnational. It's like saying that an entity that has as much connection to a foreign government as the U.S. government has all the rights of an American citizen. If you wanted to say, listen, we're an American company, we have no subsidiaries any place else, we represent, you know, as this country goes, we go, which was the case with most corporations, say, 60, 70, 80 years ago, perhaps that would be one argument. The argument, though, that these companies that are citizens of the world should have the same sorts of rights as an American citizen strikes me as illogical. If you wanted to say what entity is the bedrock entity that stands in the way of any sort of meaningful reform that voters might come up with, I think it's the Supreme Court at this point. But the potential to perhaps hear some other voices in the discussion, like I said, Elizabeth Warren is able to be useful whether or not she would actually adhere to the things she says, you know, when not a president, if in fact she ever got elected to the job. In the same way that that's useful, there were some interesting, perhaps encouraging signs out there connected with the presidential debates. Now, something we've made many a point of in the show in the past is the fact that the two parties have a stranglehold on the U.S. system here. And one of the ways they have a stranglehold, especially at the presidential level, which is becoming more and more important as both the House of Representatives and the Senate seem to become more and more marginalized, as we said in the piece, you know, we just talked about. I mean, we have people in the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate saying they're not seeing this stuff that the executive branch is negotiating. So it's not just the electorate that's being cut out of this stuff. More and more, even the elected representatives of the electorate are being cut out of these situations. There's a move to petition, I guess you could say, before lawsuits are filed, the Democratic and Republican Party members who control the presidential debates demanding that they include someone else. In fact, so much of this show has revolved around trade agreements, right? Coincidentally, the last time you saw trade agreements brought up as an important element in any presidential debate was the last time a third person, someone who was not a Democrat or Republican, was in those debates. 1992, when Ross Perot, a billionaire, managed to spend a ton of his own money and get in the debates. Ever since then, the rules have been increased to make it increasingly impossible for a third member to join the debates, and there hasn't been one since, right? And so once again, you end up in a situation where you have a Democrat and a Republican only up there in the presidential debates, and neither one of those people brings up any bipartisan disagreements. So anything that both parties have a hand in is off the table for discussion, and it often includes things like these trade agreements. So there's never any debate between, you know, potential presidential candidates over whether or not, for example, it's a good thing to have secretive debates where the U.S. electorate is cut out of, you know, being able to follow anything. This story is from the website The Hill, written by Jonathan Easley, March 17th, 2015, and the headline is Adding Independent Voices to the Debate, from the beginning of the piece, quote, "The battle over the 2016 presidential debates is already underway. A new national campaign, Change the Rule, it's called, is pushing for the Commission on Presidential Debates to include a third party or independent candidate in next year's debates. A bipartisan group of more than 40 current and former elected officials, cabinet members, diplomats, high-ranking military officials, and business and academic leaders are backing the effort," end quote. Now that's interesting, folks, because this isn't a bunch of fringe, outside, you know, far-left, far-right people doing this. This is insiders, including Democrats and Republicans, who are petitioning the Commission on Presidential Debate, which is controlled by Democrats and Republicans, to open up to third-party and independent candidates. It's rather interesting. The group is called Change the Rule, and the story continues, quote, "In January, Change the Rule sent private letters to the Commission on Presidential Debate board members requesting a rule change to remove some of the barriers to qualification facing non-major party candidates. Quote," and this is from the letter, "because the current rule affords independent candidates no chance to get into the debates, it dissuades men and women with extraordinary records of service to this country from running for president," end quote. The letter, which hasn't been released publicly until now, reads in part. The letter continues, quote, "As a director of the CPD, you could ignore this complaint and wait for the ensuing legal process to play out. We think it would be a missed opportunity and an unfortunate mistake," end quote. The story says, quote, "The group says the terse response it received back, a two-sentence letter expressing gratitude for the input, has provoked them to take the fight public and take aim at the CPD, which activists describe as, quote, a secretive quasi-official group, end quote, of 17 unelected members," end quote. The Change the Rule group did their own calculations to try to figure out what it would take for a candidate to receive enough support to meet the minimum qualifications set by this combined group of Democrats and Republicans that control access to the presidential debates. And here's what the story says, quote, "Change the Rule estimates that to receive 15% popular support in a poll, a non-major party candidate would have to spend close to $300 million to reach parity with the major party candidates. The group is pushing," the story says, "for an addendum to the current rule that would allow a candidate who gets on the ballot in states with a total of 270 electoral votes to qualify for the debate," end quote. In other words, folks, they're taking an idea that we've had on this show and mentioned many times, my at-large berth idea, and asking the Commission on Presidential Debates to employ that. In other words, instead of just having two candidates, they would also include the next most popular figure. That's a great idea. It's one of those things that makes you think that there are places where we could begin to make some progress on the other side. I mean, if this is a scale and everything seems to be in one direction lately in terms of, you know, the way things are evolving, you need to have some hope on the other side of the scale. Some hope would be people who could get in there who aren't a part of this setup we have, right? Who, I mean, this is what I like about Elizabeth Warren. This is what I like about some of the candidates on the right, too, that just don't seem to be in the club and seem to be willing to say unpopular things that challenge sort of the status quo. I mean, that's what I vote for these days, folks. I go for people that are against the current status quo, be they on the right or the left. And I don't trust them. I'm not naive enough to trust them that if they get elected, they're going to do what they say. At this point, my standards are so low, I'm supporting them for the fact that they're saying this stuff at all. And if they could say it on a stage as large as the presidential debate stage, well, that'll be even better. And those of us who are old enough to remember the Ross Perot candidacy, and Perot was a terrible candidate in so many ways, but what was so wonderfully refreshing about him was that he wasn't one of the big two, he wasn't part of the status quo, and he hammered both the original George Bush and Bill Clinton on issues that the two of those guys would have rather swept under the rug because they were bipartisan problems created by both parties and involved things like trade deals that they did not want to have a public discussion about because just for the same reasons they're keeping the TPP and TTIP negotiations and stipulations secret, it's tough to defend to the general public these things that seem so weighted in favor of the elements that are providing so much money and support and power to the elected officials at the expense of those who are supposed to be the ones empowered in a democratic system, us. These days, when I go to the website at Audible to browse some of the audiobooks so that I can recommend one to you, what I normally do is pick a book I've read, although occasionally I've told you about books I haven't read. But normally I'll find a book I've read, and then when I see it on Audible, I'll click on the sample link that allows me to hear the narrator. And it's a little like watching some favorite book of yours that's been turned into a movie. You kind of want to hear if the voice that they use matches the way you kind of heard it in your head. And sometimes, most of the time, it's like sort of neutral and it doesn't really matter one way or the other. Sometimes you get this voice that just is jarring compared to what you expected. And sometimes you get this voice that just makes the book that you read even better. I kind of like the voice on the book that I'm going to recommend to you today when I sampled it. It's one of those books you kind of have to be a nut about the Roman Empire falling. But for those of you who like that subject, we could just read book after book after book, you know, with some new spin on an old theory, because they're all old usually, on why Rome fell. Now, if you go to Audible, there's like 100,000 titles to choose from, all kinds of genres and categories, not just books, but magazines and periodicals and stand-up comedy bits and old radio shows and all kinds of different things. But of course, you know me, I gravitate towards the history. And the other day when I was looking on there, I found The Fall of the Roman Empire, A New History of Rome and the Barbarians by Peter Heather. Now, we used this book when we did the Thor's Angels hardcore history episode. And it's the best way to describe it is it's like one of the really recent defenses of an old idea for why Rome fell and involves the barbarians and all this. It's a particularly it's one of the strongest theories that have been thrown out there over the years for why Rome fell. And if you're a history nut like me, you know the why Rome fell question is a perennial arguing point. So, you know, decide which idea sounds best to you and go with it. But Heather's giving you sort of the conventional approach, but putting a new swing on the whole idea and doing it in a way that at least I found remarkably entertaining while at the same time being scholarly. So if you're a fan of that subject like I am, you could pick up The Fall of the Roman Empire, A New History of Rome and the Barbarians by Peter Heather on Audible. And I think you'll think, as I did, that the narrator actually adds something to the story, which is a pretty good story to begin with, if you like that Fall of Rome thing. And you can go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin and get your free audiobook download.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter. The address is @DC Common Sense.
Are you feeling guilty yet? A buck a show. It's all we ask.